So, people, oh, this is better. I was having some trouble with my gear here at Tischlein Deck Dich, Mesita Kubrite, or as we like to say in English, table set yourself. Table set yourself. I welcome you in episode one of this incredibly hilarious show. This is me, myself, and my podcast. This is Sam. Yeah, that's my name. I'm your host for today's show, and I'm gonna teach you something about history, just as last time. Well, about last time, I gotta clarify a few things. When I was recording this episode, which is to become the first episode in English of my podcast, Tischlein Deck Dich, I wasn't even aware that this was going to be an official podcast episode. But afterwards, I felt this was such a special day, such a special grabación in Spanish, special recording, that I had to include this in my podcast role, in my normal podcasting role, whatever. I'm on a roll here. Yeah, I just stumbled in my room here, and I went straight to my studio setup here at my desk with my microphone, and I'm here, and I'm just on a roll. On a roll. Yeah. Gotta say this. Well, that was just, yeah, it was just overwhelmed a little, and last time might have been a bit confusing that I was referring always to Adam Curry and John C. Dvorak. So that's the thing I gotta explain first. Because I like to record lots of stuff, lots of podcasts in German and Spanish also, but mainly German, and also private podcasts, like just analytical, psychoanalytical things, talking about my life. And I was getting into this last weeks, talking about my life, private stuff that shouldn't be published. But I was getting into this feeling that I was speaking for Adam and John, the host of No Agenda podcast, which I got to know about through the host of Aufwachen podcast. Aufwachen, yeah. Aufwachen podcast from Thilo Jung and Stefan Schulz here in Germany, which is the greatest podcast in the universe, if you ask me. And I was so impressed by this podcast, Aufwachen, that I started my own podcast 2 years ago. And especially Stefan always liked to talk about No Agenda, like to say, oh, yeah, that's interesting, although a little conspiratorial. Yeah. Well, what can we do? What can we do? Those Americans always part of some conspiracy, yeah. Well, it's a conspiracy state, really. But caught up in a conspiracy. But he recommended very much to listen to it, and I did so for many years, also on my big journeys. I made world journeys about in many countries after I finished my bachelor's degree. And I always like to listen to No Agenda. And yeah, therefore, I was just getting into this idea. I was talking about John and Adam, about my life, my problems, and yeah, about this erotic stuff also. This is maybe, I don't think I'm gonna send this to them. Just really the last episode is going to be public. But that's why there was all these allusions about, yeah, swinish stuff and these things. That this is really private. This I gotta keep to myself, I think, at least for the moment. I mean, it's too explosive to for you to handle, dear listeners. I know you're just the niedere Volk, as we say in German, the gemeine Volk also. Yeah, it's the people, the common people. Yeah, and the common people, they are just of this nature that they can't handle too much at once. We gotta be careful with them. They're just, well, let's face it, they're just stupid sheep. And so am I, people. I'm not better than you. I'm just talking here again and letting out all my aggression and resentments. I'm resentful also towards America. And therefore, I gotta penetrate the American American market to really bring about revolution there. And this brings me to an important discovery that I made in Nojenda. Nojenda claims to be a conspiratorial podcast, claims to be, oh my god, so conspiratorial and so much, deconstructing, media debunking, and they claim to have no agenda by themselves. Of course, they're so objective. And well, maybe they are, but that's exactly the problem. They don't want the revolution. They don't want the big uprising. They're afraid of it, in fact. And that's the problem. I mean, you can criticize all you want, all your life, all the bullshit that media emits on TV and radio and podcasts. Well, you can do that, but that leads to nothing if you just say, oh my god, I'm so scared of the new world order and what will Klaus Schwab be doing to me. And that's just so ridiculous. I mean, you're such conservatives, you're such, I don't know, right wingers. I mean, yeah, I think it's accurate to call you that, because the United States in itself is just a right-wing state. It's just fact. I mean, just as the BRD, the Bundesrepublik Deutschland, the state here in Germany is also a right-wing state. It's just integrated in our very constitution, of course. That's a right-wing constitution because it preserves capitalism. It opens all doors to the bourgeois, to the ruling class, to the capitalists, who are our rulers, the enemies of the proletarians. They are really our masters, and we are subservient. And so am I, and I'm just in the process of freeing myself and, yeah, taking on these other podcasts. I gotta smash them, I gotta say it. Not gonna be left much of you if I'm done with you, yeah. So, but Nojenda, of course, is a huge point of reference for me also. As I highlighted at the end of last episode, it's also, yeah, a big role model. I like the way they're talking and like the way of thinking. But still, in the grand picture, their worldview is completely reactionary. And this was made clear to me one day when I was stumbling through the streets of Buenos Aires, where I was living, as I explained last time. But this year, for the first time since I lived there 10 years ago with my family, for the first time I returned there with my girlfriend. Now, she's from Peru. Yeah, Peru. But we took this decision to make our first vacation together as a couple. We might call it our honeymoon, yeah. Although we're not married, but it was like a honeymoon vacation, really. And so nice. So sent the sweetest greetings to her. She's really the sweetest girl I can imagine, I can dream up. And yeah, it's just a Peruvian girl like you can't find one like this in the whole world, I think. Peruvian avocados are so good. John liked to talk about them. He likes Peruvian avocados. And yeah, many fruits there, many tropical fruits. Peru, I think, is just a great country. But let's talk about back in January. I was in Argentina and I listened to this American podcast. Well, No Agenda, which has just no agenda at all. Yeah, just no plan for revolution. And well, they were talking about, there's this whole situation, this big problem in the US with the homeless. Oh well, you know, streets are crowded, and I myself visited the US once 4 years ago at exactly this big world journey after I finished my computer science career. Also slid by there just to see and just to, yeah, I liked the country very much. The people also, it was really a special kind of people also, if you compare it to the rest of America. I've been to Mexico, to Peru, Colombia, Chile. And also to some places in Europe. Never been to Asia, really. I think just Turkey. Turkey, I think, is the most eastern I've got. But, well, Americans are special in a way, and they are effusive. They are, hilarious, let's say. Oh yeah, they're talking so loudly, especially in California. They're talking like, oh my god, yelling at you. And their voice is so powerful. I want to be that powerful too here. So, and I was traveling there. I got to know the country, but just for 10 days, I think. It was the end of this big journey. And whatever. But now I also saw the homeless situation there. Pretty grim, of course, in the streets of LA and Las Vegas, which I also visited. And, well, then in this podcast this January, Adam and John were talking about, oh well, you know, the situation is so grave, what are they gonna do, is there gonna be a big uprising? But then they reflected, well, but it couldn't be organized. How could the homeless organize themselves? And Adam Curry brought up this idea. Oh, I think, what do you think if it would be a podcast that guided them? You think that's going to work? And John, I don't know what he said, but just for me, Adam's reaction was very subtle, very crucial, that he saw the way I perceived this. He saw this as a great threat, this uprising of the homeless. Because, yeah, he's a Kleinbürger. He's also a bourgeois, but a small one. Ah, Kleinbürger. It's a pequeño burgués, petit bourgeois. Yeah, you're a bourgeois. You think you're a bourgeois, although you're not. You're just as proletarian, dependent on your salary, your income. Income not from capital, but from work. And yeah, but you think you too, just so you're so beneficiating of this capitalist system. And yeah, that's your mindset. And therefore, they were just like, oh no, what could be happening? This can't happen, that a homeless rise and just causing trouble, just putting up an army. And but me as a communist is, for me, it's clear we have to educate the homeless, the proletarians, all the suffering human beings in the US and everywhere else, so that they can succeed in an uprising against their government and establish a communist government. And yeah, in most countries of the world this needs to be done, except in a few like Cuba, which has already a communist government, which is good. So yeah, I was just thinking, wow, they're so reactionary. I mean, they're doing this great podcast, but why wouldn't it come to mind to them that they just could say, oh well, yes, we're gonna do this podcast to coordinate the homeless uprising and tell them, well, we gotta center our forces, make a concerted action and make protests, peaceful demonstrations. Well, we could make a whole hiking trip throughout the country from LA to Washington and there to the Capitol and the White House and surround it just by millions, well, let's say 1 million of people. I mean, in Washington DC there are so many homeless, they could be just would grow so much, this whole exodus, you might say. It's really a Völkerwanderung. Oh my god, exodus. Oh yeah, that was what it would be. And this could be great, could be powerful, and well, there could be violent outbreaks, but that's really the point. We gotta educate ourselves through the lecture of Marx and Lenin, and those are the great role model, especially Lenin, because he also did something practical, not just the theoretical work like Marx, which is also highly important, highly appreciated, but still more important is the practical side of things, like what Lenin and all his co-fighters, co-politicians, and all the workers of the Soviet Union did in this workers' state. And yeah, with that, I'd like to thank you for your courage and just say, I'm on a roll. I'm gonna keep going in this historical direction. Today we're gonna keep it short because I just returned from a trip with a friend, a conservative friend, which is really in a reactionary mindset, even worse, much, much worse than our agenda. I mean, it's just disgusting, discussing politics with him. It's so painful, but whatever. We were there in Athens for 5 days, and it was a beautiful trip. It was sunny, it was great weather, just one day a little clouded, all the other days really sunny, and Athens is a outstanding, miraculous city. So many hills, so many ruins, and especially these models, these sculptures of male models, male sporting figures throwing their discus, making all kind of sports. I think there came to mind to me. A saying of Friedrich Nietzsche, a German philosopher, which I highly appreciate, although he's not a communist, wasn't a communist, but yeah, he said something like, today in the modern times we think about beauty, human beauty, more in terms of feminine beauty. It's all about women and they're so beautiful, but back then the Greeks thought of beauty in the first place as male beauty, and also homosexuality was very common back then, was very, a thing that was incorporated into culture, the love of younger men, also older, powerful, richer men also could love younger ones. That's some kind of pedophilia, which was totally accepted back then. And yeah, maybe for this reason too, they just appreciated male beauty so much. And they showed us, I mean, it's really impressive. I was in this Acropolis museum just 2 days ago, and those statues, oh, they're staggering. I mean, those muscles, the belly muscles and the arms, and oh man, even for me, as I consider myself heterosexual, it's just a normal, straight, cis guy, but I mean, if you see these kind of bodies, you get into thinking, you get into grübeln. Yeah, but never mind. Just brooding. Oh yeah, that was beautiful. And I was wondering why there were not so many naked women statues. Just Aphrodite, the divinity, the goddess of beauty, she's portrayed with a naked body, but just the upper part, I think. And I don't know, it doesn't matter. Just came to mind the saying of Nietzsche, yeah, for the Greeks, really, the male beauty was the starting point, was their main focus. But let's proceed now. I want to say something about this friend. It's a conservative friend, and I don't like discussing politics with him, but either way, I enjoyed the stay with him. He doesn't like to listen to my podcast because he doesn't like left-wingers. For him, all the media landscape here in Germany is left-wing, of course. And yeah, I want to say something about Hitler. Last time I explained my view on history and on my German people. Yeah, it's lost territory. Therefore, also I feel the need of talking in English. And Because, yeah, I want to talk to the world, not to the Germans, those boneheads, just knuckleheads or whatever. Yeah, as John called them this one time, because of all this masking stuff and pandemic and, yeah, it's bullshit. Well, it's right, yeah, they are boneheads, they are just whatever. And we are, I should say, as I should adequately say, yeah, we, the Germans, the Nazis. And, yeah, this Nazi stuff is pretty severe. We gotta talk this through. This is nothing I can just put aside with one episode. We gotta really think about history. And what I was already highlighting, mentioning last time is this overly excessively talk of Hitler here, this moral discourse. This is the underlying tone, as I said. Yeah, it's always present, like in the big unconsciousness, subconsciousness of society. There's always this Hitler thing, the Hitler era present, and this Nazi stuff, and we just think, oh, well, I mean, yeah. What I just gotta express here is very, is a difficult remark, but I'm anti-fascist, of course. You gotta fight fascists, and it's good to be hard on fascists and tell them to fuck off. It's just not acceptable, and there are many fascists here in Austria, in all these countries. And there are many people like this conservative friend who's just, he's a semi-fascist, I would say. He just wouldn't mind fascism. He just doesn't think about these terms. He just says things like, oh, well, they didn't do everything wrong back then, the fascists, oh well. And when we visited in Athens the Olympic Stadium, where the Olympic Games back then were held in the antique, and then there was the museum with all the posters of the modern Olympic Games and Berlin in 36, and he said, oh well, that's just a nice poster, should carry it. Maybe I could buy that. Well, that's not as bad, but what he said then, that just got on my stomach. He said, oh, why? I think Berlin should apply for the Olympic Games again in 2036. Why not? Yeah. And yeah, this kind of tone, this kind of thinking, it's like joking, but it's, yeah, I see that in a lot of people here in Germany. They're either openly right-wingers voting AfD, which is the right-wing party, or would consider themselves conservative, like this friend, and votes for the major party, conservative party, CDU. But they're really two of a kind. This conservatism and fascism, for me, it's two of a kind. I mean, in a critical situation, conservatives will again support fascism, and, well, we also saw in the Nazi era here that not many fought them, just the communists and even the social democrats were voting in accordance with Hitler, were just passing his laws. And yeah, it just gets me sick thinking about, in the media you have this high-sounding discourse of we Germans, we just changed so much, we're so different today, so moral, and this is a totally democratic liberal state, and we ain't doing shit like that, like the Nazis did. Well, we still invade other countries like Afghanistan, Yugoslavia, but that's totally different, right? And yeah, what I want to express is that this friend is also just a product of his environment. We all are products of our society, of our culture. But he's just formed that way by media, by this capitalist bourgeois media. And they want to keep us in this mental darkness, in this really, yeah, dark place, where we're just obedient servants and going to work every day and, yeah, thinking, well, Friedrich Merz, this leader of the city, he's the guy, he will rock the boat. I mean, you just gotta support him. and it's just so reactionary and yeah, the exact basis for such a false view on history, on the Nazis, and playing down the crimes of Nazism, playing down the whole ideology. And this is rooted also in this high-sounding Hitler discourse that we have in the media here, but not only here in Germany. I also see it, of course, in Argentina and the US. I think in all countries around the world, in this documentary channels, there are Hitler Nazi documentations around the clock. It's just a theme that, yeah, gets the attention, that gets people's attention. And yeah, I think this overly excessively emphasizing and English is not so steady, not so far. Just this context creates the situation where a guy like this friend of mine would think, oh well, maybe, yeah, it's excessive. I mean, it's a Schuldkult. It's a cult of how guilty we are. It's a cult of guilt. And, well, it's just too much, he thinks. And after all, it wasn't that bad with Hitler. Well, it was a bit excessive, killing so many Jews, so many people, executing this genocide. But after all, who knows? Maybe, I mean, they also did great things. And that's the kind of thinking that comes around at this this high-sounding discourse. And that's a problem. In a liberal society, Nazi opinions are always allowed. And that's going to lead to a catastrophe. That's just what's going to happen if we keep going down this path. We have to decide. Either we just prohibit such Nazi opinions, we just have to say no, that's not acceptable, you cannot express such views, it's not acceptable neither in media nor in private discussions. Well, private discussions of course should have more liberties, shouldn't be punished so harshly, but especially in media, and this right-wing media like Bild, which is the biggest German newspaper, Boulevard Press. We have to really also make purges there, like Stalin did back then. We have to purge some people and get them out of their position of power, because they really perpetrate deeply reactionary up until fascist views, or they just set the table for this fascist view. So first, just what happens then in the brain of my friend, that he just, well, thinks it's all the same, fascist, communist, democratic, who knows, just get this feeling from him that he just doesn't really even form an opinion, he just spits out a couple of words, just spits out what the media put into him. Just spits this out, a general, disbelief. And yeah, that's the thing. It's kind of subversive, thinking of himself as also subversive. Oh yeah, there's this media unity front, there's this media, great media narrative, and I'm also subversive. Just as no agenda. Well, I don't say that you are on this really... playing on the train of playing down fascism. No, not accusing you of that, but you also are thinking of yourself as subversive somehow, even though there's just no one defending the capitalist order more rigidly than you are. I mean, you even said it once, John said, oh yeah, we're straight up capitalist, oh yeah baby, that I think Adam added that, oh yeah, baby, we're capitalists, right? And yeah, I mean, what else is there to say? If you're capitalist, if you're so convinced, convinced capitalist, and capitalism is just the system, the economic, political system that we have on the world stage, but the main power, of course, is the US. If you just accept and actively support that, then you can't be subversive. Then you're just the biggest pillar of this system, and they're just procreating this system day after day after day, after episode after episode, because you give your listeners this feeling, oh, well, yeah, this is also some kind of subversive stuff. We're also rebelling against the powerful class, the ruling class. But, well, somehow we're just sane and we're just staying in line. We're just, well, thinking for ourselves, not accepting the mainstream narrative, which is good, of course. But you're not taking the next step of forming an alliance, really getting to know the historical fights and reading Marx, which is really crucial, and thinking about which stance to take here, how to look at such a revolutionary occurrence like the Russian Revolution, and what did this really mean for humanity. In my view, of course, it was a great shining light of hope and of inspiration. So, okay, I've expressed that, which is difficult, that, yeah, it's good to be anti-fascist, but just in the way we see it in today media landscape in Germany especially, it's not that good. It's just creating the base in which many people think of it. Many people want to downplay fascism and want to say, oh, well, it's all relative, you know. Stalin also killed people, Mao also did, and we don't know. Hitler, after all, might not have been that bad. And I say, yes, he was that bad, although I would say not that singularly bad. I mean, it's not like Hitler is the incarnation of evil or something like that. Yes, it is evil, and it is shameful today being German and seeing our wealth, our prosperity grounded also in this time of fascism, and then all this, which I explained that the US needed to pamper us, to build up again all the factories and bridges here, and say, well, we gotta keep them prosperous so they don't become fascist anymore and threaten our power or leading role in at the world stage. And yeah, this is a very, very sinister world order after 45, and many countries are just fought brutally against, like the Soviet Union, and then was split up after decades of this brutal fight of the US and its allies against communism. Well, yeah. And I say it is very, very bad what the Nazis did, yet I wouldn't say it's so such a singular thing, because, yeah, what I already laid out, you can't just look at history and just reduce it to this one point and say, oh my god, this is so impressive, and now we just look at this one thing and can't even think further anymore. What happened after, what happened before with the Russian Revolution, we can't think about it. It's all, yes, like Hitler's the gold standard, the Holocaust is the gold standard of all genocides, something like that, and that I criticize very much this view on history, because this means, looking at history like this also means granting the Nazis a further victory after the victories they already had in the World War and the millions they murdered or starved to death, like in Leningrad, in St. Petersburg. And it would just be another victory, because then we would look at the Nazis, at these kind of Übermenschen, this kind of superhuman beings that were so strong and were killing so many, and just that is the sign of their strength, that they were able to kill so many. No, I just say no, it's not a sign of strength to kill many people, because if you just have superior weapon power, like also the US colonizers did when they killed the indigenous in the United States in the 19th 19th century or before, it's also just a very coward thing to go there with your rifles, and it's just superior arms to the indigenous, and yeah, just kill them, just slaughter them. And yeah, it's the same with Hitler. There's nothing impressive, because also the Soviet Union was a very underdeveloped country still in 1941 when Germany attacked them. And yeah, there's nothing great about it, there's nothing strong, it's just coward, it's just dumb, and it's shameful, and really, really, yeah, just, I mean, you just gotta set it, lay it aside and say, wow, they were really dumb motherfuckers, those Nazis. And yeah, but there, in history there has always been violence, there have been genocides, although maybe this was a really different scale, a really huge scale, but still, it's they did nothing that spectacular. They did what other people had already done in the centuries before them, just slaughter other people for ethnic or religious reasons, just for pure idiocy and this resentments. And yeah, they did just exactly this. And we shouldn't look at the Nazi time today feeling like this was such a superhumane structure, society. No, it really wasn't. And yeah, that's why I say no to singularity. And also, speaking of my experience in Argentina and in many countries, I think also in Greece there are Nazis today, but in many of these poorer countries, like Argentina, well, Greece is not that poor. I saw also they're really part of Europe. There's really one level of prosperity here in, or at least the more developed Western countries, and Greece is also more part of these Western countries than of the really poorer Eastern countries like Lithuania and those EU members. But still, in all the countries there are Nazis, and there are people looking at German history and finding some sign of strength and yeah, just momentous I don't know, vigorousness. And this is very sad and very false. And therefore, I also experienced this in Argentina with the classmates and with the normal people there, that they have this outlook at Germany. And well, one thing, of course, they admire us for our wealth today, for our effectiveness, our industry and cars. But on the other hand, also, I just gotta say, I just perceive this admiration for the Nazi crimes. And although this is not pure admiration, it's also like angst. Also, little, they feel a little threatened or uncomfortable. But they also look at this Nazi time and wow, seeing this as wow, this great, great German people just fought so many other people and it was just so victorious. And no, that's just plainly wrong, and we need to fight that view of history, but we won't fight it with that naive discourse of overly emphasizing how moral, how anti-fascist we are today in Germany. No, this is not going to happen. This is just going to worsen things, and many more people, like in Argentina, which is today a really suppressed country, bled out by the IMF and all this financial power of the Western imperialist states. Well, I think it's logical that people there might look at Germany again and see they, after all, they were successful with fascism. Fascism did bring them forward, put them forward after the Treaty of Versailles and this great humiliation. And therefore, fascism could be something good. And no, we have to avoid that view on history. But that's exactly what's happening in so many countries around the world. And Germany is prosperous today. Germany didn't suffer so much from losing the war. Just a couple of years, there were shortings in food and stuff, but then again the economy, of course, took off, And yeah, here we are. So this is a very, very bad situation, if you think about in historical terms and in terms of what kind of role model are we, Germans, for the world. We are a fascist role model, a role model of how fascism can work. And even if it doesn't come out as you planned, even if you can't take over the world, well, still you can be a minor ally then of the US, the supreme world power then, and just make profits again and just be dominating Europe, which is today the case in Germany, which is the biggest power in Europe. And yeah, so that is very gefährlich. Peligroso. I don't know. Why can I come up with this word? Gefährlich. Peligroso. Oh my god, come on. Now the internet is failing. Oh man. Everything. Well, whatever. I think I've made the point. I think I've made my point clearly. And now, we don't have much time today because it's late. Yeah, I've had this trip from Greece. Tomorrow I will be working again. And I just want to say, open one more topic. Well, it's the same topic, of course, but with Stalin and Hitler and the whole transcurse of history pre-World War and how it came about, the Stalin-Hitler Treaty, the Treaty of Non-Aggression between Soviet Russia and Germany. And yeah, we want to study that today a little with this great biography of Stalin that I read from Ian Gray. I think he's a British historian, maybe American, I think British. But he's a good writer, and he's neither communist nor anti-communist. So he's somehow objective, although objectiveness is not really a goal that we should aim at. It's not that good to be objective. I'm just here partisan, of course, communist partisan, and that's just the right thing to do. But yeah, we'll see, take a look into this book. Stalin, Man of History, is its name. Sorry, people. I'm a little sick. What's the matter with me? So yeah, I just gotta be clear, the Germans were not strong, and I also regret saying that in the last episode. Oh, they're so strong, killing so many. And that's exactly this kind of mistake, but yeah, maybe also just necessary to express that. Doesn't mean just no sign of strength to kill other people, especially if you have such superior weapon power and industrial artillery is just coward. Just like what the Britons did in China in the Opium Wars. They just slaughtered Chinese people. They didn't have firearms. And yeah, there were many uprisings in China also in the period when it was colonized, and they were brutally slaughtered. And that's the same thing. It's not a sign of strength from the Britons, but it's a sign of cowardice and really nothing to be proud of, nothing to be... Yeah, and that's the thing. We're today in this overly political correct identity politics talk, and I think that's just some kind of psychological thing also, that the Western societies in the US and Great Britain and Germany, they all feel kind of guilty for the past, for the colonization. And that's right, yeah, there is a lot of guilt that we accumulated, but they feel, oh no, of course we can't end capitalism has to stay. That's the big doctrine here, of course, and the doctrine that also Norjana signs off on. So yeah, that's the point. That's the irony of it. Of course, no agenda has an agenda, and this agenda is just keeping capitalism alive. I mean, yeah. But, okay. And it's just worse if you're not even paid for by the US government. I mean, they should be paying you because you do a good job at that. But if not, you're doing this just out of conviction. That's really even worse, if you look at it. But yeah, there comes just this feeling of guilt, and these people, especially countries with the dark colonial or fascist past, like Germany or Britain, and think of, well, what can we do to improve minority rights or change our language in order to be inclusive? And I'm not totally against that. Of course, it's also excessive, yeah, and many of the debunking in our gender is legitimate, is good, but still there is a valid underlying point. You'd have to be more radical and say, well, the problem is capitalism and all that we accumulated by this, for example, in this British colonialism of China and of many other parts like India, all that we accumulated helped build our economy, helped build a strong capitalist economy, and helped keeping other countries, other people down. And just as today, we're still using that supreme financial industrial power, supreme market and money power, currency power, of course, the currency monopoly of the United States and dollars. We're just using that to suppress other people, and that's a big problem. And to be really anti-racist, anti-colonialist, anti-fascist, you'd have to make a revolution that dispenses this system and comes up with something wholly different, like a socialist revolutionary state. And yeah, and socialism, like in the DDR, German Democratic Republic, there were also mistakes, there were failures, and was not a perfect system, but it was the right system at that time and the right project, the right historical movement. And we're going to take that up again, of course, but first we have to bring about revolution. That's why I'm talking here to you. And yeah, of course, it would be great to see a revolution in the United States because it's the most powerful country. It can be a positive role model for other states, not like today. It's also a very negative role model, of course, just Germany. So yeah, I was coming to this, to reading, I just like to read in my podcast, also in German, just reading from several books. Yeah, I'm kind of an intellectual. I like to think of myself as an intellectual kind of philosopher. Let's read a bit in that history book. Yeah. So we have this year Stalin, Man of History by Ian Gray. In this, talking about this whole situation pre-World War and the relations between the Western bourgeois states and the USSR, the first socialist state in the world. So that's page 236. I'm reading it on a Kindle, of course. As communist Marxist, you can't just dispose, just put away all this capitalist produced stuff. I mean, also in socialism we'll still produce stuff, and it's just our environment, yeah, that just also produces me, and I'm using all these gadgets, and it's normal. It's really a stupid argument to bring about against communists, to say, oh yeah, you're also using Apple technology, and how can you be dare to be Marxist? It's so stupid. I mean, well, but let's just read this, please. Yeah. In 1933, Hitler came to power in Germany, and war clouds gathered over Europe. He had repeatedly expressed his hostility towards the Soviet regime and proclaimed his demands for the Ukraine and other Russian territories to meet German needs for expansion. His aggressive policies were disturbing. Throughout the first years of Hitler's chancellorship, however, Stalin made no public reference to Germany. The Treaty of Rapallo
and the two subsequent pacts were still in force, and he was hoping that Germany would continue to observe them. But he watched closely for signs of Hitler's real intentions. At the 17th Party Congress in January 1934, he made cautious reference to fascism as a symptom of capitalist weakness. Oh yeah, baby. That's right. I think that's a good point. It's fascism is really weakness. He went on to say, of course, we are far from being enthusiastic about the fascist regime in Germany. But fascism is not an issue here, if only for the reason that fascism in Italy, for instance, has not prevented the USSR from establishing the best relations with that country. Nor is it a question of any alleged change in our attitude towards the Versailles Treaty. We simply do not agree to the world being flung into the abyss of a new war on account of this treaty. So that's very wise of Stalin, that the Soviets already saw the big mistake that lay in the Versailles Treaty in humiliating Germany and just provoking them to being aggressive, being militaristic again. So that was the end of this quote. The Nazi leaders became increasingly aggressive and abusive. Stalin remained cautious, and he did not exclude the possibility of an alignment with Germany against the capitalist West. Bukharin and others did not share the ruthless logic of his view that any alliance was acceptable if it ensured Russia's security. They would have preferred alliance with the more civilized capitalists rather than with the barbarous Germans, and at the Congress, Bukharin made a savage attack on Hitler and his policies. In the event, however, Stalin's proposals for a Russo-German alignment and a few months later for a joint guarantee of the inviolability of Finland and the Baltic states were rejected by Hitler. While careful to placate or at least to avoid provoking Nazi Germany, Stalin grew more disturbed by Hitler's bellicose declarations. The German-Polish non-aggression pact suggested he was fostering Poland's claims to the Ukraine and perhaps envisaging how the two countries might share the vast steppes between them. Stalin's first concern at this time was the security of Russia's frontiers. The way was clear for a German advance through the northern Baltic, and with Polish compliance, the central route to Russia was open. The treaties signed by the Soviet government in the summer of 1934 with Czechoslovakia, Romania, and Bulgaria gave some security to the southwestern frontier. But Stalin knew that the centuries-old hostility of the Poles toward Russia made them his most dangerous neighbors. During 1934, he worked on a reorientation of Soviet policy. His plan was to forge strong alliances with the countries of Eastern Europe, but this failed because of German and Polish opposition. It was necessary to cast the net more widely. In September 1934, Soviet Russia joined the League of Nations. Reporting to the 17th Congress of Soviets on January 28, 1935, Molotov spoke of the expediency of collaborating with the League of Nations, although we are not prone to overestimate the importance of such organizations. He went on to condemn German racial theories and quoted Hitler's Mein Kampf on the policy of territorial conquest directed at Russia. He spoke of the growing strength of the Red Army and of increased Soviet defense expenditure. He conveyed a strong confidence in the might of the Soviet forces. But the Soviet leaders were desperately worried. The pace of German rearmament, supported by highly developed heavy industry, far outstripped the rate of Soviet expansion. Exactly. And the thing is, although that the working class, the masses of the people in Germany were far more educated, far more able, because, yeah, they had already all this tradition of maybe one century of industrialization. And in Soviet Russia, this process was just in the beginning, just in the Kinderschuhe, as we like to say in German, in the baby shoes. Yeah, it was just being started about 1930, all this heavy industrializing program. So, yeah, this was just an unbalanced fight, and the Soviet leaders and Stalin knew this and sought to avoid the war at any cost. And also, therefore, this treaty came about in 1939. Later, we'll read about that. The Treaty of Non-Aggression between the Soviet Union and Germany. And it only came about because all attempts of Stalin failed to secure a pact with England or with France, because they were so passive. Those regimes, the bourgeois regimes of Great Britain and France, were just so, well, so cowardice. They were cowards, thinking that, well, whatever happens, we'll just hope that Hitler might turn eastwards and attack the Soviet Union, and we don't have to make a treaty with Stalin, because, well, they just fight, they just weaken each other, and we'll be safe here. And yeah, that was a big miscalculation, and they paid dearly for it, although not as dearly as the Soviet Union, which lost many, many more millions of lives than these other countries. Over 20 million. And yeah, so the treaty in 1939 was the right call to make, but we'll read about that later on. And Molotov, he would become the foreign minister of Russia, of the Soviet Union, just in 1939. He was, but already back then, he was high-ranking position of the government. In 1935, Stalin began seeking alliances with the capitalist West. For years, the United States had stubbornly refused to recognize the Soviet government. Communist doctrine and propaganda about the evils and imminent collapse of capitalism had antagonized American opinion. The United States had enjoyed great prosperity during the 1920s, which was taken as proof of the superiority of capitalism and democracy. Any expression of support or sympathy for Soviet Russia was liable to be condemned as un-American. Confident, and it's also this talking in our agenda, of course. Oh yeah, we're so American. And what they also said in the podcast I listened to in January in Argentina, oh, back then in Lenin's time, the US government was shipping over the dissidents, the American communists, were just taking them, putting them on ships and sending them to Soviet Russia, saying, oh well, they're your brothers, you just can go over there. And well, it's good as a communist to work on the building of socialism in such a developing country, which is setting this, is following this goal of establishing socialism, overcoming the capitalist order of production. But there's also the point, me as a German, I also want to be here to bring about revolution here in Germany, because it's a highly developed, very powerful state and would have a much larger impact on the world than a revolution in a country like Greece or Argentina, which is a small country. And Germany is really a role model for the world. And therefore, it's also good to be here as a communist and to say, yeah, we must destroy this kind of democracy, this kind of liberal market system, and impose a more civilized socialist economy. And that's really a momentous, gigantic task of changing the whole functioning of society and the way people think. It's just hardly imaginable, but still we have to imagine the nearly impossible. As communists, we really have to build bridges into the future and see in the future and say, yeah, it's possible. And the Soviets show us what was possible in this time. I mean, they were so backwards, and yet they fought the Nazis and they won by enormous human costing human lives and suffering, but still they won. And yeah, they achieved also other great things for their own people, for the lives of their people. But of course, this victory over fascism is the most important landmark in this first period of the Soviet state in the era of Stalin. The most important achievement. Because if not, they would just have been slaves, just treated as Untermenschen, inferior human beings by the Germans. But let's go on a little. Confident in its wealth and strength, the United States felt no need for diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union and took a strong moral stand against communism. But trade flourished between the two countries during the 1920s. Americans traveled freely to Russia, and American engineers and technicians contributed to Soviet industrialization. Yeah, that's also good. That's also something I, as a communist, can be grateful to America. They really sent the engineers, all the factories and supervisors to really get the process started, because that's really such a hard task to train the workforce, the workers in new methods of production that they aren't used to. It's so difficult, and it's crucial, of course, to have help from other more developed countries. And the Americans did that. They also financed Hitler, of course. You have to also mention that, but still can be thankful for this contribution to Soviet development. The economic depression brought a sharp change in the American attitude. Business interests began pressing for recognition of the Soviet government in the hope that it would increase trade. It was, however, the need to counter the growing dominance of Japan in the Pacific that brought the change in US policy in 1933. The Roosevelt administration, on coming to power, was ready to act, and recognition of the Soviet regime quickly followed. The Soviet press was jubilant in hailing the new treaty with the United States. But relations were at once disrupted by disputes over the repayment of loans made to Kerensky's government and over Soviet propaganda. The truculent behavior of William C. Bullitt, the first US ambassador, aggravated the conflicts. However, a trade agreement signed on July 13, 1935 gave promise of more friendly relations. Okay, I think it's good to read until here. We're already at an hour, and I gotta draw to close of this episode here. I like to speak at length, of course. I won't be satisfied until we have succeeded with the revolution. And of course, the revolution is a large, painstaking and also beautiful process that will go on also after the revolutionary situation, after the displacement of the former government and after the seizing of the industrial factories, means of production. We will still be in a stage of revolution years for years and decades. And that's just a gigantic task. And so, yeah, I won't stop podcasting. But for today, I think, let's call it a day. Let's say there's lots of stuff to discuss about German cowardice, German savagery. We'll discuss all that. we'll discuss American relations, Soviet relations. And yeah, maybe one thing I can say is this, that the embodiment of socialism, for me, as I explained in my German podcast, maybe is that in every country, every people, every human being could be attractive to you in an erotic sense. And this is the very socialist core of all of us. I mean, if you just think about that, that you could feel desire for a woman or a man from whatever country, from Africa, Asia, America, well, it's just, I just think of three continents, because Europe is not even a continent by itself, it's all Eurasia. There's three continents in my mind. Let's say Australia is also an island, well, and Antarctica doesn't count, not important. Let's say America, Eurasia, and Africa. Those are the continents. And yeah, whatever one is from, you could feel some attraction, like between me and my girlfriend. And this maybe is some kind of socialist feeling, that really there's no borders in that sense between human beings. We're all kind of the same. We look different. But if you feel that you can love another person that's really totally different, maybe in terms of skin color or culture, language, you can't even understand, but you can look at him or her and or whatever gender and just feel this gloom, this bright light, and this shining blizzard of emotion, of erotic feelings. And this is just a very obscure line of thinking that I'll be expounding. I'll be working on that line of thinking. Just wanted to mention it here. My German listeners already are familiar with this kind of ideology that I'm building up here. I like to call it sex communism or love communism. Or maybe love socialism. Let's see how we'll call it. I'm just working on that, and yeah, I mean, this is the thing. We gotta really show that we're willing to help other peoples to develop their countries, just like the US did back then, and that's really a great historical achievement. It's really it was really a moral thing from the US, maybe also from capitalist motivations, but never mind. They just sent their engineers there, sent all the material, and trained the Russian workers, and that's a very difficult process. I think if we today, as Germans, we would have to send our workers, our engineers, to Morocco or to some state of Africa that's nearby, but very, very poor. And yeah, we have to show them, but this can't happen in terms of a few years. Training the working force would be really a task of several generations, maybe, or at least one generation. You have to train them while they're young, of course, because afterwards you won't change their minds. And that's also the problem with fascism. I think after 45, you just can't change the mind of people that grew into the fascist Hitler dictatorship and believed all this ideology of German superiority. And those people, yeah, sadly, just then continued believing this and saw in the German wealth accumulated after 45 this sign, and yeah, saw this as the great expression of that. After all, Hitler was right in some point. After all, yes, Germans are superior in some kind of way. And yeah, I want to say that you have to train them, educate them while they're young. We have to educate our children in Marxist doctrine. And this is not some totalitarian ideology, but what the state we're living in today, the state of mind, the ideology of liberalism, that is really totalitarian. And liberalism here in Europe means not, like in the US, what it means over there is left-wing policies, but here it means more like liberal economic thinking, more right-wing party, like the FDP here is a liberal party. They're more on the right, but liberalism is the ideology that frames all of the political thinking. Even the left party here in Germany is deeply rooted in liberalism and is not a communist party at all, and is really just a just a puppet of this bourgeois regime here, and just supporting this unrightful regime, this ruling of the capitalist class. And that's the Die Linke, Die Linkspartei, which is a shameful party, a disgrace to every true communist. But okay, people, I gotta stop here. And what I can tell you is that I like to play songs. I'm kind of a DJ, like I am, yeah. I'm playing songs here. And what I can play for you, ladies and gentlemen, to end the show for today is one song that I have in mind. Well, I don't know. This one song that I like, that I just discovered, is Sweet Little Lies. And I think it fits because talking much about history, about the lies of the bourgeois liberal view, outlook on history. Yeah, that's what I'm gonna uncover here. All these lies, and although they're always claiming to have learned the lessons of history, and oh yeah, they have learned how bad Hitler was, and we just took our lessons, and I just want to clear this up and say no, we didn't take the right, we didn't learn the right lessons, and it's a hard way to really educate yourself and being consistent in your view and thinking on history. And even I myself, of course, have to improve my ideology, and therefore I work on it, because that's the deepest Marxist doctrine, that is just, yeah, work is everything for a human being. Work is the very basis of life. Without work, you are nothing. You're just the worker is transforming his environment and is creating therefore a boundary between him, the individual, and the environment. And that's the deep philosophy of Marxism, which of course is more sophisticated, but I think that's a very crucial basis. And yeah, therefore you can also just understand, educate yourself by working. You cannot just passively consume, although of course you, dear listeners, are consuming now and maybe you're learning something, but the real work is you have to do by yourself. You have to think or write. Just write up some stuff, write some critique of my arguments, or just, you can also grab a mic and make a recording, send it to me. Yeah, you have to do something. You have to get active, participate, and being this active process, and only then you will truly learn something. And okay, now I'm gonna play this song. It talks about lies, and yeah, sweet little lies that are just so easy to believe. And well, I wouldn't mind, but I do mind the lies of German history, the lies of the self narrative that we believe here. My God, my internet is failing here. We're really a failed state in Germany. Oh my God. Okay, doesn't matter. Just listen to this song, and yeah, I welcome you all, people of the world. I embrace you. I want to give you a hug and say, maybe even send you a kiss. But foremost to my girlfriend, of course, which is to me the most beautiful human being. And yeah, send love to Peru, because she's now at vacation. Back there, and yeah, just, we're gonna be united soon, but today I feel this separation, and she's with her family, and I send these greetings and love and hugs, and yeah, people, enjoy the song and see you next time around at Table Set Yourself. Yeah, Table Set Yourself is this program.
Something on your mind, something at your back, you're trying to forget. Something in your heart that once I tore apart. Something tells me that we're all lies. Yeah. Cannot see. Something in the dark seems to fall apart. Something tells me that we're all lies. Hey! Sweet little lies, words come and go. Something, if there wasn't something.